And we're on. Welcome to the Endoseeking Podcast. This is episode 29.
And if you hear any strange noises, although I doubt you will, the house across the road is being gutted currently. So we've got builders throwing rubble everywhere.
Yeah, you probably won't hear it, but if you do, forgive us. okay, do you have any announcements?
Not announcements as such, but just to say that I'm in the last week of my month of light. I kept saying the 11th of March, but it actually ends on the 10th of March, which is the new moon, and that's this Sunday.
Sunday.
Yeah.
Great. I started my, what do I call it, Spiritual Foundation series of satsangs. I started that on last Saturday, and I covered meditation. It was really lovely. When a few people, you know, nice little group showed up, and we had some interesting inquiries into the value and of meditation and whatnot. This week, coming up Saturday at 5 p.m. UK time, is the second week, and I'll be going into self-inquiry, which should be really cool, actually.
Juicy topic.
Because there's so many, I say it because there's so many misconceptions about self-inquiry. Absolutely. How to approach it specifically and generally. Yep. So I'm going to, like I did with meditation, I want to kind of bring the essence of it and make it sort of simple so that it can really serve one's own, you know, own clarity.
Beautiful.
And practice. So that'll be Saturday, self-inquiry. If you want to find out about that, go to my website, martinweber.com/events. So that's martinweber.com/events. And if you want, sign up to my mailing list. It'll keep you up to date, or get on my Google Calendar for future events. Okay. So we have a couple of things we were thinking of talking about this week. Let's start off with, which one do you want to start off with? Choices. Expectations.
Yes, that's what I was about to say.
Expectations. Specifically, expectations in relation to spiritual awakening. And how those expectations can actually get in the way of you seeing what's often right under your nose.
Yeah. I was saying this the other day to you, and this is a slight exaggeration of it, because it's not really true. But a lot of the work I do is obviously meeting people. But a lot of the time, it's bumping into people's expectations.
Right.
A lot of the time. And it's amazing how, and we all have them. It's not, you know, no one is unique in that, I think. We all have these expectations. How the mind sort of imagines awakening will be is never actually the truth of it.
Yes.
And it's sort of fascinating to see what expectations the mind kind of comes up with there.
Yeah.
And depending on your maybe background, your what you've been exposed to as well, those expectations.
Or in terms of like traditions or teachers and teachings. And
yeah. And I think the idea to talk about this came about because those expectations often have a timeline to them as well.
Uh-huh.
So this idea of like, well, there's an expectation that I will get somewhere.
Right.
In this amount of time, X amount of time.
Right.
And actually what that does is stop someone from taking a look right here, right now.
Right.
And sinking into this present moment, which contains within it that which you're seeking for.
Yes. It's interesting because that, you know, is so evocative because this was my experience, your experience. I've been involved in what one might term a progressive path, meditation, you know, continuing to culture the physiology, let's say, is the general idea, which isn't wrong in its sense, culture physiology and the mind, let's say, to more and more appreciate, cognize the nature of being. So that's great. But this idea of enlightenment's at the end of that road.
Yes.
It's up there. It's over there. So you keep doing and one day it'll turn up as opposed to a more direct path of self-inquiry.
But actually, as I said just before we came on here, was actually, if you really look at the true essence of meditation,
absolutely,
it is not a progressive. Well, it is dropping you directly into the truth of your own being in this moment. That's the goal of meditation in many ways, you know. And so meditation paths are often labeled as progressive paths, maybe rightly so, but meditation in itself is not progressive in that it has the potential to point you directly to really
drop you into the moment.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm off the mic then. Drop you into this moment. That's its goal. That's its origin even as well. Exactly. You come to see that the whole, all of this work, quotes, of spiritual practice and inquiry and whatever is all about rooting yourself in the lived moment.
And in order for that to really take hold, it is often a case of rooting out and dissolving and dropping those expectations that seem to stop one at least, from the direct recognition of your nature here and now.
Yeah.
So expectations, I think, are an important topic because it's often those expectations that occlude us from the recognition of our nature.
Well, it's something to do with the expectation of how it's going to come about, what it's going to look like and feel like, when it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll definitely have this phrase of, you know, in some sense, engaging in these expectations that somewhere in the future is a sort of the practice of, in a sense, kicking the ball down the road. Mm-hmm. I remember watching Papaji do this so skillfully, you know, bringing people in real time, you know, so effectively back. And, you know, this is the great practice of satsang and self-inquiry is to consistently bring the attention back to now rather than letting it run away. Oh, I'll get it when. Once I've put this in place, once I've achieved that, then, you know, but those are ego traps. You know, ways of avoiding, you know, the fire of the present moment in some sense.
Yeah, the surrender into the present moment. It's often stopped by those expectations of, well, I have to get this right. I have to get, you know, it's like gathering all your resources around you. This assumption of like, I have to gather all these tools, all these resources. And once everything is set in place, then...
Yes.
I'll be good to go.
Yeah, it's like perfect yourself before. I'm sure this question came up somewhere. Do I have to, you know, kind of somehow improve or perfect my ego, my person should I do that before I go into before I seek it, awakening? So that's. It's interesting to see how the mind kind of doesn't even realize it's just putting these obstacles between us and the, as I say, the moment, the lived being here and now.
Yeah, are who we are. I mean, you can use, you know, fancy words or whatever for that, but actually at the end of the day, it comes down to that simplicity.
Yeah.
Who are you?
Yeah.
Who am I?
Who do
I think I am? Not my false presumptions of being a person and a mind-body experience, but what is my essential primordial nature? It's very simple.
It's too simple, isn't it? In so many ways. Yes, that's the common refrain.
Yeah.
Could it be this simple?
Yes.
Yes. There's this other expectation that of what it's associated, what enlightenment looks like in a person.
Yeah.
And we've bumped into this several times, and it's common that although it's shifting, I think it's shifting more these last bunch of years, the internet years, I think things have in this area have shifted, and it's to do with what an enlightened person looks like. which by projection means what you need to look like in order to be enlightened.
Yes.
And so pre-2000s, let's say, my experience was the only enlightened beings that I was exposed to and identified were Indian yogis, Zen masters, right? There's a certain cult.
Christian mystics,
right? That there's these people there. They stand out in some sense as either being part of a tradition, but there's sort of some, we've talked about this before, this sense of like, they look like a monk, or they look like a guru, or they look like something.
Aesthetic. They have,
there's a lot of spiritual trappings around that.
Is that the right word? Aesthetic?
A spiritual aesthetic. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, that can be very distancing.
Yeah.
Because if you're, and you know, for myself, that, you know, I came up in, you know, Buddhism to some degree, but, you know, TM and the Vedic approach, and of course Maharshi and all his masters were Hindu monks.
Yep.
So that's a great, you know, I'm not that, never will be that, don't come from that culture. I'll never be able to look like that, and nor do I need to, or did I ever need to? But that can be very psychologically distancing. That, and a big shift for me happened when I got exposed in the 2000s, more online, to regular looking awakened people.
Yeah,
I think some of the first were people like Adyashanti. He came from a Zen tradition, but he wasn't a monk. He was married, living a normal life, and seemed like a regular guy. He was one of the examples. And seeing then realizing there's a whole slew of people out there awakened in normal life,
yeah,
not set apart and living in a particular, you know, spiritual context as a renunciate, as a monk, as a nun.
Yeah, when in TM they use the word householder.
Yeah, right. Which comes, that was one of the other things we were talking about, funny enough, we've segued onto this.
Yeah.
Was that, you know, you look back at that, what was taken as that sort of tradition is, and Shankara himself sort of said, there's two paths here. There's the householder and there's the...
Yeah, and in Buddhism there would be renunciate. The lay.
Yeah, the lay Buddhists and the monastics or the monks and nuns. So and the expectation actually comes with that is if you're in that former category, the lay or the householder, it's almost don't expect to get enlightened.
Yeah,
like your best shot at it is probably to accrue sufficient merit, so in the next life or in some life in the future you're gonna become a renunciate. It was so tightly associated, the idea of being a renunciate.
I would say it wasn't so much in the TM movement.
No,
that there wasn't so much that
that became
separation. That it was that householders could attain,
yes,
that realization.
Yes, yes.
And
but that was new. I mean, that in some ways, that was in some sense a sign of, you know, the novelty of, you know, of that Maharshi's teaching was to bring this, you know, these kind of techniques for great clarity and samadhi into the hands of people who weren't necessarily run off to a cave or an ashram.
I don't know. I'm sure we've said it in the podcast, or maybe not. But certainly in various interviews you and I have both done over the years, that was my experience when we first sort of got together, was this sort of thought that you would going off,
yeah.
Yeah, you know,
fully
into your cave.
Because sooner or later I would go forth.
Yeah.
Because that, again, that's what I inherited in a sense, that expectation. It's a very pernicious expectation. Yeah. And maybe it was true for a very long time that the likelihood of awakening within a householder context, living your life, you know, paying your bills, right?
Yeah.
You know, going shopping, doing all that stuff, having relationships. So it actually took you and I to... quite spontaneously grow in our path individually in unison with each other, you know,
mm-hmm.
Like to realize, oh, that isn't true.
No. And I think that there are more and more exemplars and more of that reality.
Yeah.
That it awakening does not have a requirement on it in terms of a monastic lifestyle.
Yeah.
That actually living your life, having your job, having your relationships, living in the world,
yeah,
does not preclude you from
full awakening, yeah, and true absolutely awakening. Yeah.
And I think, you know, to go back to expectations, I think it's becoming more and more accepted as a truth, but I see it so sneakily in the sort of the minds unconsciously often. I see it in the expectations of what awakening looks like are still holding, yeah, on somewhat to those monastic viewpoints, yeah, of awakening.
Yeah, right. Definitely. Although it is shaking loose now, yeah, and there's more and more and more and more and more examples of people living, abiding awakening in what we would term normal householder life. More, yeah, and more of that. It's funny that it was only after I had my shift into non-duality that I actually looked around and saw, wow, I could throw out a net, and there's that person, just people I knew, yeah, who were like, oh, they're awake.
It's not some rare bird.
It is rare, but it's also not rare. Yeah, it's exactly rare, but it's increasingly common as just the normal developmental stage. It's profound, life transforming, but it is, yeah, at the same time, I believe, our birthright to come back home to our own nature and live from there.
I agree. And I think actually everything is set up for that. Again, you have to drop the expectations of the timing of that, the way that comes about, yeah, how that comes about. But I am very much in the camp of the viewpoint that says everything that happens to us, mm-hmm, is a symptom of consciousness waking up to itself.
Yes. Yes.
Everything. That is, I mean, I don't often put many stakes in the sand, but that for me is,
yes,
I am fairly willing to put a big stake in the sand for that one, that everything that happens to us is in service of that.
Yeah.
Everything. And I'm not just talking spiritual things here. I really want to emphasize that. I'm, yeah, really saying everything here.
Yeah. The whole thing. And that's the, yeah. What I want to touch on there was sort of wheel back a little bit to this householder renunciate sort of dyad, that I think the emergence of many, many, many more householders or lay people coming into full abiding awakening and living their lives is new. I think this is new in our history. I mean, maybe some way back, but if when I look at, you know,
at least fairly recent history.
Yeah, I mean, thousands of years. When I look, yes, look at it, maybe there was some Vedic civilization 5,000 years ago, which would had a higher incidence of, mm-hmm, you know, that's a prehistoric case to make, but certainly in the last whatever couple of thousand years, and I say that having surveyed, you know, the nature of awakening over time in different traditions and what those expectations are. But I think I would make the case, there you go, I'm going out on a limb now, I make the case that something's afoot, that this is actually a change, and I think it's facilitated in a big part by the internet, mm-hmm, by this communication, the access to the teachings and the energy and the presence of enlightened beings all over the world, and being able to connect and compare. Something has emerged in the, yeah, regular person. But my point is here that it in light of that fact, as I believe it is, it brings with it a new set of challenges for that type of person who's waking up and living in enlightenment.
I had someone ask in satsang on Sunday, how do you, and this was a very, I felt a very practical question here, how do you, I don't know the word, rectify the difference between, you know, abidance in the absolute and paying your, the relative paying your bills, you know, I felt was a genuine question of, you know, how does that work? How does that sort of, how does one, I'm losing my words today for some reason.
How do you resolve that tension? But I mean, the easy answer to that is paying the bills happens.
Yes, that is the answer, is that there is no separation between absolute and relative. Mm-hmm. Relative is temporary, changeable, experientially coming and going, but it happens all the same.
So the question of it comes with this presumption, right? Mm-hmm. That how do you go out and pay your bills? You know, in the sense that, oh, well, because if you wake up, you're going to look like a monk and you're going to be completely incapable of functioning in the real world. So, but I think that is some of that new set, those new challenges are, how do you,
because it is a step out
of that safe particular context of monastic life, for example, or living in the woods.
But it is a different functioning.
It is.
Forget about the monastic for a moment, but just the practical realities of awakening. It is a different functioning, but not in the way you might think. It's still playing out. Functioning is still playing out exactly as it always has, but it's where the functioning is playing out from. That's what changes. So the doer is what changes, not the doing.
Right.
And I think that's the thing that gets missed so easily, is there's an assumption in there that if there is no doer, as in the bottom falls out of the person, that no doing will happen.
Right, exactly. And it's still trapped in some weirdly personal view that it needs a doer, and when they're gone, you get, well, it's that trope, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you cease to be a doer, you're going to sit on the sofa all day. But no, because there never was a doer, and it was already functioning quite naturally, taking you to the shops and taking you to work. Yeah. And
there was just an overlay commentary that said, "I am doing this." So this is why I say the functioning is exactly the same on one level, but on another level, completely different. It's because it's the functioner.
Yeah,
that's a funky way of putting it. But it's the doer that shifts. There's the perspective of that drops out.
So in a sense, the experience is sort of being moved by being itself. Somehow there's an awareness of moving without will, almost. It's like this takes you, that takes you. You move in that direction. Move in that. Yeah,
that's how. That's the in my mystical heart,
isn't it? I think he calls it.
What's that?
One of Adya's books is called Emptiness Dancing.
Yeah, I would say in my mystical heart, that's what it feels like. Yes, it's like that's the experience, at least, is emptiness dancing.
Yeah,
it's the silent heart of being dancing in being as being.
Yeah, it's so this individual will of it all sort of.
Yeah, and so there's a big
not quite so. I mean, there's a sense if I could, one way of putting it, is the sense of sort of being moved somehow, like the movement isn't a personal movement, even though it looks like a personal movement.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. But I had this thought as well, actually, about just on a slight different tack on this idea that traditionally these teachings were held in monasteries and ashrams, and were coming from those who themselves were living out their awakened being within that context with their own expectations. And I don't mean to say that they are whole, that obviously the teaching is sound and full of, you know, is spontaneous in itself. But I think it's interesting to just note that this, that, what am I trying to say here? That those teachings are going to have the perspective of being of what it is to be a monk also, or to be a guru.
Not only that, but they also have cultural overlays to them.
Yeah.
So not only do they have the sort of the monastic overlays to them, they also have cultural overlays to them. Absolutely. Depending on where they are in the world, there might be certain cultural expectations there that are, I mean, I see that with some of Maharshi Mahesh Yogi's
The
instructions. You know, they, the knowledge in there and the way that the movement was set up, their, particularly their view of women, for instance, I see a lot of cultural stuff in there that is not really appropriate for this day and age. It may have been appropriate for where he, the time he was born and the location and the culture he was born. But actually, it, there has to be a recognition of that in within the teaching so that you can recognize what is truth and what is a preference, as in what is what is essential to that teaching and remains true no matter what time, no matter what culture, no matter who is approaching this and practicing this. What is the most essential teaching there that is pointing one back to the truth of themselves? However, there are also then are preferences and overlays and experiences that aren't absolute. They are provisional. They are this overlay of,
I call
of
the bells and whistles.
Yeah, and they can be helpful. It's not that they're not helpful.
But sometimes they might be
exactly
occluding.
Yes, exactly.
Because the let's say the peripheral preferences, let's say, but they have no bearing on whether one is serving one in awakening or not.
That's what I mean. Sometimes they can be helpful for an individual that they're helpful, you know, that individual that's helpful, but another individual, it's occluding. And so therefore, they should be related to in that manner in terms of take what resonates, take what applies and leave the rest.
Yeah.
Sometimes it is very hard to discern that between the difference of whether this is helpful to me or whether this is actually unhelpful.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we definitely, you know, witness so much of this in a movement like the TM movement around.
And it's not unique, just to put that caveat in. It's just what we have most experience with, but we saw it in other movements we were involved in as well.
Because the teacher and the tradition came from India and broadly Hindu with, you know, definitely a revivalist Vedic approach. And so much, don't get me wrong, I love that. It's beautiful.
Yeah. But it had a lot of trappings in there, including things you had to wear, things you had to eat, things, you know.
Yeah, which had nothing to do with the Western context.
Yeah, and the...
Or enlightenment in itself.
Exactly, that's what I was about to say. They're not essentially pointing to this is an essential teaching, and without this, there is no way in which enlightenment will come about.
Yeah, so I was going to touch on that actually about this idea that, and I hear this a lot, even among awakened teachers, that, oh, as long as you do this, you won't get enlightened. If you're doing this, you won't awaken, that kind of stuff.
And that's the overlay that they are experiencing may be true for them.
Yeah, also it might not be true at all. And one glimpse of it, go, well, it's evidently not true because there's plenty of people who are doing X and quite awake and they're doing Y and quite awake too.
And I've seen, you know, I've seen...
Things like diet. I'm going to name it. Things like diet. I've heard this a few times that people say, oh, if you eat meat, you'll never wake up.
And I've seen,
for example,
people,
it's just evidently not true.
Yeah. And I've seen people who we have known, and I'm not going to name names, obviously, but, and they've stood on the fence of saying, not the fence, they've stood on the ground and said, this absolutely has to happen in order for awakening to happen. If you are doing this, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And months, years later, they themselves have encountered the untruth of that.
Yeah, evidence and had that is not that way.
And have had to, you know, come back around and go, oops, hands up, sorry, you know, I thought this, but now I don't.
Which is just, I mean, a big one for me, we've mentioned this before, was my own belief that relationships as such, you know, marriages, were completely antithetical to awakening. I thought as long as I was, you know, in that, you know, I wouldn't. And that's such a long-term trope that comes, again, it comes from that tradition of, you know, whether you're talking about Jesus and the idea that Jesus was a single rabbi living his life doing that, and you had to live that way, and that's in that tradition, and then you had to be a monk in another tradition in order to awaken. Again, it points that you've got to go on your own, and of course awakening is one's own nature, so it is in a sense a solo affair. It was really lovely to find actually that I didn't have to go off to a cave. I didn't have to lose you in order to come to my own clarity of my own being, and vice versa.
Mm.
And so it's been and it's been a profound relationship on that basis.
One of the greatest teachers. Yeah. Actually, for me, it's my personal relationships actually that have been my greatest teachers. Yeah. And even though they may not seem like these great, you know, teachings of the great traditions or whatever, actually, practically speaking, personally speaking, you know, they have been where rubber meets the road, kind of. Those have been the teachings that have really taught me of my true nature and also the nature of the person, the nature of this human experience. It's very much in our personal interactions in life that are the greatest teachers, I feel.
Yeah, I mean, we've been living this out for so many. Well, a whole relationship, but post awakening, it's been, you know, just endlessly deepening.
Yeah.
As like mirrors to each other, it amplifies instead far from holding back deepening understanding, insight. It's actually amplified it to a huge degree. And Cynthia Bergeau has talked at length about this. I might have mentioned this before, and she would call it and sort of formalize this notion of conscious relating. That, you know, you and she, I think she wrote a book. She did. I think she wrote a book about Mary. She did write a book about Mary Magdalene, as I understand it. It was a lot of that book was about this idea that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were together.
Mm-hmm.
But more than just being romantically together, that there was a deep spiritual relating there, that each of them sort of nourished each other's path through that process of mutual mirroring and commitment to truth, commitment to, you know.
Yeah, which I guess would have happened in the monastic tradition, would have happened between the guru and the student or the disciple.
Yeah.
That's where that would have happened in that context. But in a householder context, I think that's
what, well, I think that's what looks like. Cynthia was talking about, less that guru student model, actually two contemporaries, let's say, two people on the same level. She had a friend, she said, she talked about, who was, because she's a single, I don't know if she's a nun, but she's certainly an Episcopalian teacher and scholar and minister. She's single, but she has this spiritual friend that she has, and they serve that relationship really deeply, mirroring each other in truth, in truth, in truth. I found it to be the most amplifying, most enriching relationship, and in service, complete service to awakening. I think instead, far from being
Yeah, because in that way, it's like, you know, we are having to, there's a mirroring to the other, but there's also it's a two-way mirror, so to speak, yeah, that is happening in each interaction. And so it requires one to do their own work while being present and holding the space for the other one that is doing their work,
to hide.
And vice versa.
Yeah.
And that's challenging. It can be very challenging. It's very beautiful as well, but it's a real fire.
Yeah, it can be. It can be. Yeah, it can be. Yes, there's a fire. Yeah. But again, so this comes back more to as an illustration of the point that these expectations, you know, it might be worth looking at your expectations and then going, what if this was exactly opposite of the truth? You know, oh, you can't be in a relationship. What if actually it turns out the relationship is in fact the most conducive thing for your own awakening?
And vice versa, actually. You could say even, you know, the expectation that you have, you know, we've been talking about the relationships right now, but that's not necessarily everyone's path as well. Like, also, like, right, if you have this expectation of, oh, I need to be in a relationship, you know. So I think the general point you're making there, if I might, is that its expectations are often the thing that is the problem here, not what the expectation is, but the fact that there are expectations. And so to really, I think the word that's coming is humble ourselves to our expectations, to really alight in that sense of, I don't know, actually. I don't know. Any sense of what I think this will take and any sense of rules that I have somehow made for myself as to what awakening, how that will happen, what will that will take, how that will look, all of these things to really hold incredibly lightly. I mean, really incredibly lightly. And actually, for me, expectations is often speaking of future. It's this sense of when this happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a distraction from the present moment.
It's all somewhere over the rainbow, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Just somewhere beyond the horizon.
Yeah.
Oh, my, it's there. And that's actually really keeps you cozy and safe.
Yeah.
There's a real a place to hide.
Yes.
In future. Because you don't have to do the hard work now. If you think, oh, I'll get there sooner or later. I can enjoy my life. Sooner or later, I'll have to give it all up. Sooner or later, I'll have to surrender to the divine. Yeah. But for now, I'm just working on my program.
And this brings up another thing for me, slightly sideways subject, but and that is the projections of what you think awakening will look like, and it's the projection of looking at another awakened being and going, oh, they don't have to deal with this, they don't have to pay the bills, they don't have to. And that to me is a way of distracting from your own nature, like assuming that this difficulty you're having in this moment you wouldn't be having if only you were awake, if only you were like them.
Suddenly it's all easy, blissful and everything.
Yeah, and I bump into that an awful lot, is people's ideas of my experience of life. And I think that's part of what this podcast is in many ways, is to just be open and honest and, you know, have these kind of conversations so that people can maybe see what awakening is and what awakening isn't as well.
Well, I found it really helpful in my path, and I, as I said earlier, to see that they were normal people.
Yeah.
That suddenly the examples of enlightened beings that I was seeing were actually, I could identify them. Oh, yeah. He looks just like me.
Yeah.
You know, in a sense, it's no, but still there's some subtle projections going on. Yeah. And I have this sort of theory, if that's the right word for it, that along a spiritual path, it's a path, how it shows up or can show up as a closing of the distance between you and truth. So the example, and I'll map it out in my own path, before, you know, long ago when I was sort of the earlier stages of seeking, I'd be reading the books, I'd be, you know, looking at things, and it was all very distant. It was there, good books. And then I found myself getting involved with like TM and actually having a practice. And so I'd learned a practice and I was doing that and I was maybe going to the odd meeting here and there. So again, it was all very, very local, but very, in a sense, distant. But as time went on, it was like you come closer to it. You're getting involved with it more. And so as time goes on, I find myself like in a satsang group or something like that, or in a non-duality, you know, talks with someone who was awake and might be in the group, but it might be in the back.
Well, I was going to say there's one step before that, which is online. So it's one-way street. Right. It's like you are in a satsang, but it's...
Yeah. You're at a safe distance,
exactly.
But you're approaching it. And then you can find yourself, and as I did, you know, find myself much more in relationship with someone who's there, someone who's awake. And that was because the point is you get closer and closer to it and you want a purer and purer expression of it. And you just get closer and closer to it. And so that was my sense, you know, reading books, you know, maybe learning some technique, maybe getting in satsang, but online, sitting on the back, but maybe in person, maybe one-on-one then, maybe actually getting to a point where you're actually sitting in a mirror situation where there's nowhere left to hide in that sense. And then finally, the breakthrough is the intimacy of discovering that you yourself are it. There's nothing closer than that. So it seems to map out that we approach it more and more intimately, closer and closer, closing the gap until we find we ourselves are
there. There is no gap. There is no separation.
Yeah. Why I mentioned that, I don't know. I forgot. I think I had a point beyond it, but that's typical.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Maybe.
Go on.
We were talking about projections. And so when you get closer and closer to,
Of what it is to sit with someone who's awake. And then you go, so many of those delusions fall, you know, the expectations, because it's like, oh, this is a real person here.
Yeah.
You're like, they drink coffee and go to sleep and drive cars. It's, oh.
Yes.
Because those, and it's the dissolving those projections and expectations that actually reveals more about who you and are and what you are in all of this.
And the fact that you are exactly what you have sought this whole time.
Yes.
Right now, in this present moment.
Yeah.
That which is looking out of these eyes right now.
This is it. You are that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's a really beautiful... process.
Yeah, and it is a dissolving of expectations. It is a dissolving of occluding beliefs and viewpoints that say I am not that.
Yes. And you know, one of the psychological barriers of identifying too strongly, and I see this a lot, especially with people who have sort of more like traditional guru types, is that expectation that enlightenment only looks like that, and they're consciously or unconsciously they're excluding oneself from the expectation that they could ever reach or grok that.
And also we've seen if they are sat in front of an ordinary person that looks like them who actually is awake to their nature, they will accidentally blindly dismiss that because that person doesn't actually look
comport
like what they
to a projected view of what it should look like.
And we've both observed this as well. So it's expectations. This is why it's such a, and I don't think we've gone into too many specifics today because I don't think you can actually. Because those expectations are very intimate to the individual.
Yeah.
I think for me, the more point is to be wary of expectations and to allow yourself to hold them very lightly and give more primacy to the present moment,
mm-hmm.
more primacy to I don't know, that curious openness of exploration, rather than sticking too much to certainties and expectations of beliefs of what life should be.
And often it's cultural trappings, isn't it? You know, that are definitely peripheral to the actual essence of the teaching.
Yeah.
Because the essence of the teaching actually is so straightforward, actually. Simple. It's much simpler than so many teaching styles would credit. Much simpler.
We've spoken about this before, of like seeking, needing to go around the houses sometimes and have all sorts of gymnastics within it,
yeah.
So that there can become the recognition of, oh, it's not that, it's in, and there then is the resting as who and what you really are always.
And it's funny, in some senses, things like spiritual practice serve a purpose that isn't quite what it seems to be, that it's often about practicing to get to a point where you recognize that this is not gonna do it, that the true awakening is the end of efforts.
Mm-hmm.
It's something else. It's grace, but it's almost, and it's a bit like people who come to, you know, the spiritual approach, who are highly intellectual, who have a very keen minds, that it might be hard for them to get to a point where they realize that mind isn't going to get them there.
Absolutely.
But those with particularly keen minds and keen intellects might take more convincing to let go of the mind.
Yes.
Because, and this is where I'll touch on next week at the end of this week, Saturday, when I'll do my talk on self-inquiry. I was just sort of reflecting on it today. The fundamental, often misunderstanding, misapprehension about what self-inquiry is in its sort of traditional style. You know, who am I? You know, to whom do these thoughts appear? That kind of thing. You don't just ask the question and then try to answer it from the mind. That's not how self-inquiry works.
Not at all.
The whole point is to use the mind to jump off into the no mind.
Yeah.
Who do these thoughts appear? And then you go look. And you rest in that abiding awareness, that pure observation of awareness itself. Drop into the, you know, it's not a case of who am I? Well, I'm this, I'm that. It's not an intellectual construction or deconstruction. It's jumping out of the mind.
Because awakening is not an intellectual pursuit.
No.
It's not just a matter of reading as many books as you can read, gaining as much knowledge as you can gain, as many techniques and learn and study. Yeah. That's not what awakening is. Yeah. It's actually all of that is in service of the ultimate surrender,
yeah,
that is required, yes, truly in awakening.
Yeah.
It's the surrender of the person. It's the surrender of the knowing and the doing into the being that we are.
And mind has no traction there. It's beyond mind. It's the source of mind.
Yeah.
So one of the great traps is to keep looking for the answers within mind. And I guess that's what happens, because if you haven't fully, properly identified and valued no mind, then all you know is mind. Oh, mm-hmm. and every other problem in life seems to have been fixed through the approach of mind. But it's it's ultimately a jump out of mind into no mind. And that's why something like self-inquiry, the question itself. Okay, that's mind, but you use the mind then to jump out of mind or to reflect back to the source of mind.
Yeah.
Source
and of also that why things like meditation as well. Yeah. I mean, there's many ways into this,
again,
but
yes.
Meditation again is not about mind, it is about being.
Yeah. So be careful of expectations.
We all have them. And so it is to watch out for them. Pay attention.
And to see where variants, projections mm-hmm. are that you're actually putting up false barriers between you and this actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And expectations are born of assumptions, actually.
Uh-huh.
And to me, false assumptions is often the very thing that occludes us from our nature.
Right.
The false assumption of I am a separate individual, yes. personal, mind, body based self.
Mm-hmm.
Is the fundamental false assumption there.
An unexplored assumption.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're mostly, as seekers, faced with a bunch of unexplored assumptions. Yeah. It's not
and
that
we suffer them.
Yeah. And it's not that they can't be explored. It's that they haven't been explored.
Yes. And of course, the trouble is, you know, there's a psychology around this stuff. So, and I've bumped up against it so many times. This notion that, oh, explore that you're, whether or not you're a person as such, a self, an ego. Mm-hmm. And some will go, oh, that's, of course I'm a person. Okay, have you explored that? No. Will you explore that? No. Right? I'm not going to explore that. It's so self-evident that I'm not going to give it the time of day to explore it. This foundational truth that when you perceive truth, that when you actually explore it, reveals something quite different. But the psychology itself and the presumption doesn't even allow the exploration to take place.
Yeah.
And of course, sometimes that can get really aggressive. So as you're approaching the kind of inquiry that leads, that begins this true exploration into whether these claims, these notions are actually true, or whether there's something else. You know, as you start to uncover and reveal the sort of emptiness of the personal self, I mean, that can get ferocious sometimes. The response to that, the defense, knowing that person who's in that, maybe in that inquiry, and knowing that instinct that to defend against what would be, in a sense, the end of the yeah. ego, the end of at least the delusion.
The
of
observational
ego.
Truth, I think, is yeah. the words that are coming to me. Is like it's an observational truth. It's not a held truth. It's not a belief. It's observationally true.
Yes, but the willingness to enter into that process mm-hmm. of progressive observation in your own experience in the present moment and go, is this true? Who am I? Yeah. Where do these thoughts arise from? Am I am I actually a person? What constitutes?
Yeah. Well, and
these ideas about
well, I think where people struggle with that is you start to ask those questions and your ground starts to fall away, and actually yeah. what comes is fear.
Absolutely.
And so for me, a lot of what I encounter with people is fear
mm.
and the inability to meet that fear. And that's a very physical thing. That's a very
yeah.
somatic thing. It's not an intellectual thing. It's you can't meet fear with the intellect. You have to meet fear in the body. You have to meet fear in the the felt sense of that.
Yeah.
So that's, to me, what shows up when you start to ask these questions, when you start to investigate your assumptions and your beliefs. I would say your false assumptions and beliefs, but let's not even go there. Just say let's.
Well, that's to be discovered.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly, exactly.
Not to be asserted. It's just
just to even go there, often requires one to meet fear.
Yeah.
And it's often an existential fear that they're meeting,
indeed,
whether that it appears that way to start with or not. That's where
well,
you
if
bottom
you're,
out
in. If one is not threatening, but if one is approaching, you know, quite purposefully the nature of ego, and you're going in the direction of seeing it as false, and you're fully identified with being that egoic self. Yeah, that means... if I go here, I'm going to die. That's the sense of it.
Yeah.
That's the
voice of it. Whether it's there's a conscious voice of that or not, it's certainly felt in the system that way.
So I guess, you know, one has to delicately approach that. And as part of the process, learn to handle the fear.
I really think that's a very big part. And I think it's a big part that is underemphasized in a lot of traditions, but I really think that's a big part of the spiritual awakening journey is being able to meet these difficult things, particularly fear.
Well, were we talking about this the other day? It came up as sort of something we haven't really talked about before, but it's a big part of what it takes to go there is courage.
Yeah, we were talking about
just courage to. And of course that comes with, you know, along with that is then maybe the necessity for trust as well. And
yes.
So, but certainly it does take courage to turn into what are and can be very difficult sensations, feelings, emotions.
Yep.
In relation to your own sense of safety.
And also it takes courage. Not only on that level, but courage to go beyond the perceived cultural norms, the orthodoxy of what is viewed. Like, for instance, I am a person. There is something that we all will bump into as that's what culture has reinforced again and again and again. I am a person.
That's the consensus view.
Yeah, and so there's the courage is to even question that. It takes a lot of courage because it has the potential, and the body can feel that, has the potential to crack open everything.
Mm. Yes, it does. I mean, awakening is a kind of a radical shift to... a place of there's no more comforting delusions there.
No.
And it's a free fall. We've talked about this, and you know, that can be, you know, experientially, there's nothing left to hold on to. There's nothing, nowhere left to sort of hide from.
No. There's, you can't.
The powerlessness. It's as.
Yeah, you can't hide in the, in the conventions of beliefs anymore. You're faced with the raw reality of truth, and that sometimes isn't comforting in terms of conventions.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, courage. It takes an awful lot of courage.
To go your own way in some sense, right?
Yeah, it takes an awful lot of courage. It takes an orientation towards truth.
Yeah.
And it takes a letting go of expectations.
Yeah.
I mean, these are some of the qualities it often takes. And I don't want to put any rules on that because it's not a rule. It's just an observation of what it requires in order to go against all these layers and these veils of beliefs.
Well, you approaching it requires a certain nakedness, doesn't it? And you have people like Shunryu Suzuki who was famously wrote his book and taught beginner's mind.
Yeah.
You know what that is really about, putting aside all your presumptions, everything you think you know, everything you've learned, and just to look at something completely fresh with no presuppositions, with no assumptions. Look, follow, go to that process. But that's a very naked experience.
It is,
right?
And it's a very immediate and intimate experience because it's not about tomorrow and it's not about yesterday. And I think we've spoken about this today in a number of different ways of that it's now, it's right now, it's right here. Now. It's that nakedness is right here.
Yeah. And in sense, that beginner's mind is the sort of beginning and end of the whole thing anyway.
Yeah.
Because by dropping it, you find yourself empty of all of these presuppositions. Now the question is, why would you pick it back up again?
Yes.
But somehow it's this process of dropping and staying in that awareness, staying in that emptiness, staying in that non-grasping openness. And never picking it up again, never picking this stuff up again, staying in the don't know.
And I would say that staying is not a prescription of tension staying, but it is a description of our nature is that. And that, so it's not like I need to stay. That's still the person there that thinks it needs to stay somewhere. But it's a description of there is a staying that happens as that.
Yes, maybe something. It's also something like a falling into into. It's effortless. You're just falling into
a repose. That's why I like that word repose. It's like it's that sense of here.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
Here.
Effortlessly here, where prescriptions become descriptions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so staying. I just bring that up because I encounter that a lot with people of like where they think that they need to strive to stay somewhere.
Who is doing the staying?
Exactly, exactly. And it's actually, not, it's just a description. It's just a description of staying is happening.
Yeah.
There's nowhere else to go. There's nothing else to be.
Yeah, because our natural being is effortless. In fact, it's the ego that takes work. It's this constant sort of maintaining, sustaining of that holding, grasping, bolstering, and it's kind of an effort. And it's like the willingness to just stop.
Yeah,
we've talked about this before.
The micro is there can be effort within the experience. There can be tension within the experience. That's the micro. That's the temporary relative view of it. But the macro of it, the bigger picture of that, the meta of that is seeing that that ground that I am is not tension.
Yes.
Is not doing. It's just this. Yeah.
In my essence, I am... a field of non-grasping openness.
Yes, even non-grasping to that grasping.
That could even contain grasping.
Yeah, exactly.
All that, but the ground, again, back to the ground, recognizing and falling into the ground of being itself, that which we are already are.
Yes.
And it is effortless and is actually, in a sense, the result of no effort. It's not even the level of results, actually. It's something else. It's
a description.
The recognition. Yeah. But somehow, what's interesting is that in light of that, then, of that rediscovery of that aspect of being, that boundless, open aspect of being, awareness, the rest of the system tends to fall into more characteristic of that that openness. You'll find the person, the person nested within that boundless openness itself tends to then become more open. It's like that quality tends to
lead the way. I would say that quality tends to lead the way, and that becomes the primary.
Yeah.
Quality that is attended to, let's say.
But it characterizes the nature of, you tend to see in awakened beings that tend to be more of an openness energetically in their system that in a sense mirrors or is the kind of manifest expression of those more abstract qualities of awareness itself.
Well, I think because those abstract qualities are the background of the painting. The background becomes more of the foreground of the painting. That analogy is often used, but it's that as you become orientated and aware of that background of who and what you are, that becomes more in focus. And so as that becomes more in focus, those qualities start to shine through.
Yeah.
And again, they are experiences. They are qualities that are fragrances of the ground. So they are not, they are made of the ground, but they are, you know, I think some people go, again, talk about expectations. Some people then go, oh, well, there should be kindness there. There should be compassion there. And it's like, no, not necessarily. They are still qualities and experiences rather than the ground itself.
Well, one of the expectations, interestingly, is that when awakening occurs, that all of these qualities that are traditionally ascribed to enlightened people, and we're all like total love, total compassion, total, you know, awareness, wisdom, all of these qualities, equanimity, whatever. And it can often be the case that these certain, I would argue that these sort of beautiful qualities, the good, the true, the beautiful, the compassion, the loving kindness, do percolate through. Awakening can happen, but it might not be so obvious. That it's not like everything's all online straight away. Like from my experience, like, you know, like the experience of deep love, you know, really kind of came on. Not that it was absent beforehand, but afterwards, it took a while for some other really deep current of love and to really come online.
Yeah.
And because I've seen so many people come to awakening and go, well, what now? And where's the bliss? The awakening has occurred, but it's like some of these qualities don't fully come online at first.
Well, I think we've talked about this in other podcasts, but there's this cleanup work that can occude one from these qualities shining fully through.
Right,
like it's not that through. They're not there. It's just that there's still those veils of leftover effects of the person and the traumas and all of the rest of that life, of that experience, that are yet to be sufficiently integrated and detoxed and all the rest of it, cleaned up, healed, whatever word you want to use there that's appropriate. But it's like, so there's still some veils there of experiencing. It's not veils of insight, it's veils of experiencing. And it's a very bodily thing, I think, often. It's like there's still densities and pockets of experiencing that that light doesn't shine through all areas as yet. But it does come. It just can take quite a bit of time, I think, to have some of that leftover stuff.
And I think integrated. This, and we've talked about this, the process of refinement as well.
Yeah.
And a refinement of perception, of consciousness, that, and I bumped into this before with someone, a few people actually, where's the bliss, this expectation again, that suddenly you're going to be, you know, a choir of angels around you all day long, and it's just going to be bliss, 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 and in this very, but the perception of bliss is going to be this very obvious thing.
Ecstatic right? Bliss.
And the experience is, well, actually drop into the experience and you go because the bliss is the very nature of this. But if we're on this sort of gross surface, even post-awakening, that's your center of perceptual gravity might actually be a slightly grosser level. It can take a while for that refinement to happen, where you begin to perceive the very subtle bubbling of the texture, the tissues of bliss as part of the very nature of your being.
Yeah.
Yeah. It might not be obvious to start. You have to kind of go, in a sense, go and meet it where it is, where it originates in its softness. And then that kind of, then that becomes kind of obvious that that this whole field is permeated and made of, in a sense, bliss, for want of a better word.
Yeah, it may not be fully manifest into the relative of the direct individual experience there. You know, the personal experience, it may not be manifest yet. Yeah. It is the source of that experience, and yet it may not be obviously expressed.
Because I think what can happen and does seem to happen is after awakening, I mean, it's happened before, so it's on a spectrum of before and after anyway, but certainly after, there can be a real drop into subtlety, drop into tenderness. That's not how we generally operate. The conditioned world is full of, it's very, you know, it's quite gross. It's on a, I mean, that technically is quite gross, on quite a gross level. Very material. Yeah,
not gross, yuck, gross.
Yeah, material. Exactly. Gross as in more embodied or something, or more
solid material.
Rather than, and sort of this progressive then perception of subtler and subtler aspects of your own being. The more tender stuff, the more subtle stuff. And that actually, as one drops into that, it becomes juicy, really quite juicy.
Yeah.
And that becomes, that then becomes, it tends to pervade the experience more clearly, more obviously. But in a sense, you've got to meet it more. You've dropped into your own subtlety of your own nature. Because you can wake up by, you know, the destruction of the self view, like suddenly you see through it. Oh, I'm awareness. And the individual ego self is seen through. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm not that. Awakening. But are you necessarily in that acutely and tenderly and delicately aware of your own subtlest nature? That's part of the movement post first stage awakening.
Yeah, so I've, you know, working with people, you can see they really have a very clear experience and understanding of the relative, and they have a very clear experience and understanding of the absolute. Mm-hmm. But it's still subtly dualistic, in that it's still subtly two things.
Right.
And how I've described it is, it's filling in the gap of that.
Yeah.
Into the recognition and the direct experience of, oh, this isn't two things at all. Yeah. This is a spectrum from the silent, absolute emptiness, stillness, formlessness, all the way up into the relative dynamic form experience of life
and everything in between.
It's not two things. It is from silence to, from the absolute, from to the relative. It is one experience from the subtlest to the grossest.
Yeah, singular wholeness.
Yeah.
Of being with two almost.
Yeah. And so you can have a very clear opposite awakening of those, the absolute.
Yeah.
And yet still there's a subtle duality that's not even seen as a duality at that point, but this subtle inability to rectify that my nature is of awareness of the absolute. And yet here is my human experience. And there can be a duality there that is hard to integrate, because it can't be integrated unless it's seen as a wholeness.
Right.
Not truly.
It's interesting. I see a lot common is awakening that happens and yet the felt sense is not properly integrated at all. That's
which are the subtler realms. Huge. The felt sense is a much subtler realm than the thought sense.
Yeah, I think that's where this post-awakening work happens for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Is the reintegration of this felt sense.
Yeah,
and they're not even aware of it, mate. You're awake, but in some, you know, to the not self, let's say.
And so to introduce a structure that we can dispense of once it's useful, but just to further this conversation, mm-hmm. you know, there can be a clear awakening. I would call that energetically, it's an awakening of the mind.
Yeah.
There's clear seeing there, but there hasn't yet been the descent. It's like there's, yeah. so there's, everyone talks about the ascent of awakening. Mm-hmm. So the broadening out the vastness, the recognition mm-hmm. of the vastness. But there is also this descent, and I think we've spoken about it in a past podcast, actually, of like this descent that starts to happen. Mm. So it's like the awakening of the mind, then there's sort of a descent into the heart, the awakening yeah. of the heart. And I would also marry that with the felt sense. So the awakening yeah. of the felt sense. And then it even goes even deeper than that into this sort of visceral
rootedness.
Yeah, really solid, grounded, rooted, it's love, but in a different form. It's love in terms of the bliss nature of it, the aliveness yeah. of it,
yeah, the very much the felt sense of the lived
yeah
being,
yeah. And so it's very, you get getting really into the subtleties of experiencing,
and this is embodiment, right? I mean, I think this is yeah. the deep embodiment, even while you're, you know, fully aware of that transcendent aspect, yeah. the imminence of our own embodiment is yeah. that gets permeated, and yeah, I mean, we've talked about stages before, so
yeah,
the continued unfoldment and those different motions of like purification, refinement,
yeah,
integration, yeah. Hey, maybe we should
finish for today.
Yeah, great. Well, thanks everyone for listening. If you feel like liking, subscribing and sharing, that would be great.
Yep.
But, thanks.
Until next time.
Till next time.
Bye for now.